Welcome back, Question Medicine 2019. This is Andrew Bill, and I am down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. And here we are, back at it again, another week, another podcast. Let's get into some of this ooey-gooey goodness. This is going to be part three, the last part of what I think are the top articles of 2018. Doesn't mean I'm not going to talk about more articles from 2018 in the upcoming weeks or months. It just means these are the ones I think you need to know about. And if you don't know about them, well, at least now you do. You can go back and read the original research, but this is just my quick little take on it to inform you of what you might have missed and kind of point out the openings or what was missed in 2018 that I may or may not have talked about. So, without further ado, without any hesitation, without any reservation, it is good to be back. All right, here we go. 2019, Andrew Bill, sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Let's talk about the rest of these articles. We finished last podcast talking about how MRIs cannot show concussions, how the FDA came out and said, hey, look at this. We had this thing for a concussion, a test that you can use for a concussion, but it wasn't really for concussion. It was for an intracranial lesion, which is a brain bleed. Now, Moving on to the next paper, which is titled Clopidogrel and Aspirin in Acute Ischemic Stroke and High-Risk TIA. This is in the New England Journal of Medicine. And this is a randomized controlled trial. And the outcome here that they were looking for is what happens if you combine antiplatelet therapy, meaning clopidogrel and aspirin, and what does that do to reducing the rate of recurrent stroke during the first 3 months after a minor ischemic stroke or TIA? Basically, they're saying, listen, we're going to give this group aspirin and Plavix, or aspirin and clopidogrel, and then the other group, we're just going to give it to aspirin, and then we're going to look at the primary outcome of major ischemic events. The reason that this is important is because the current guidelines for the prevention of stroke in patients with stroke and transient ischemic attacks produced by the American Heart Association and by the ASA, or American Stroke Association, says that the combination of aspirin and Plavix might be considered for initiation within 24 hours of a minor ischemic stroke or TIA and for continuation for 21 days. When they went to the results, the bottom line of the results is the 90-day risk of major ischemic stroke was 5% in the aspirin and clopidogrel group and 6.5% in the aspirin alone group. That sounds good, but obviously you know where this is going. With every up comes a down. When the waves come rushing in, they must go rushing back out. There was an increase in the major hemorrhages, 0.9% versus 0.4% with aspirin alone. So for every 1.5% benefit in major ischemic stroke, you're giving up 0.5% in major hemorrhage. Said differently, the number needed to treat here is 67 to prevent one ischemic stroke. However, the number needed to harm is 200. Said differently, for every 3 major ischemic events that you prevent, for every 3 TIAs that you prevent, for every 3 myocardial infarctions that you prevent, you have caused one hemorrhagic event. You've caused one GI bleed. I think most people, when they look at those numbers, they say, we save 3 to maybe harm 1, and especially if the harm is a TIA or a recurrent stroke, this might actually be worth it. This might be beneficial, but again, you never know unless you ask the patient sitting there in front of you. Now, the devil here is actually in the details, and it's probably the best part of it. If you look in the paper and you look at the curves for the study, most of the benefit comes in the first 7 days, and almost all of the benefit has been realized by day 30. Now remember, they follow these patients for 90 days, but almost all the benefit is done in the first 7 days. I mean, the two lines split early in the first couple days, and then by day 7, 8, they're completely parallel almost the rest of the next 90 days. But when you go to the harms, the bleeding risk is really not that different in the first 7 days, or really the first 30 days. but the risk becomes worse as you head out towards 90 days. This means that the bulk of the benefit is happening early when the bleeding risk was not that different, when the harm was not that different. So perhaps in the future, we will say to use a dual antiplatelet agent for 7 to 30 days, or at least for sure 7 days, and then to go just to aspirin once the patient is over the acute risk of stroke. I think this is a more solid or concrete recommendation. I recently was listening to a podcast. This is a BMJ immediate recommendation or immediate guideline follow. They're saying, listen, do this right away. It's just based on the study. This is really good. I think it's game time ready. I know that if I have a stroke patient, I am going to be discharging him for at least 7 to 10 days, aspirin Plavix, and then follow up with just aspirin after that. So that is my take on it. Let's move on to the next literature. And the next literature, well, this wouldn't be a complete review. It wouldn't be a comprehensive review if we didn't talk about three major guideline updates that occurred in 2019. So let's dig into those for just a second. All right. The first guideline is going to be screening for prostate cancer. This is in JAMA, United States Preventive Services Task Force. And they came out and said that men age 55 to 69, the decision to be screened for prostate cancer should be an individual one. They said in men 70 years of age and older, do not screen for prostate cancer. Shortly after that, the American Academy of Family Physicians came out with its update, kind of almost in response to the United States Preventive Service Task Force. And they clearly state, if you read the actual article, they state, and I quote, because it's just so awesome that they put this out there, however, based on current research data we have available, we do not recommend any patient be screened for prostate cancer with PSA. That kind of says it all in itself. But in the actual grade C recommendation for men aged 55 to 69, they say we do not recommend routine PSA based screening for prostate cancer for men 55 through 69. However, clinicians should discuss the risk and benefits and engage in shared decision-making for those individuals who are considering screening. They also agree that men 70 and older should not have prostate cancer screening with a PSA. So, one guideline says have a shared decision-making. One guideline says don't do it, but if they're going to do it, then have a shared decision-making. So let's briefly look at what does that shared decision-making actually look like. Well, you can go on Google and just type in prostate cancer screening visual or visual with prostate cancer screening, and it'll give you a nice visual that you can hand to your patient that kind of tells them, listen, this is the risk. These are the benefits of prostate cancer screening. Now let's break down some of the numbers, because every time I've ever given this lecture in the history of the whole world, or at least any time I've given a lecture talking about prostate cancer screening, inevitably someone comes up to me afterwards and says, you don't know what you're talking about. You see, I have actually diagnosed prostate cancer by screening individuals with a PSA. You have to do it. Well, you don't have to do it, because the numbers, the way that they work out, for men 55 to 69 who are screened for 13 years, not only are you likely to find prostate cancer, you're likely to find prostate cancer in 1 out of 10 or 100 out of 1,000. I mean, statistically speaking, I have no doubt that if you're a believer in the PSA and you use the PSA in your everyday practice, you have diagnosed prostate cancer in your lifetime. In fact, you've not only diagnosed it in your lifetime, you've diagnosed it in 1 out of every 10 men that you've checked, because statistically, that's just the way the numbers work out. The problem is that it doesn't matter if we diagnose it. It matters what we do for it. And what we do for it is a bunch of false positives. What we do for it is out of those 100 individuals that are then detected out of the 1,000, 80 of them undergo radical prostatectomy or radiation treatment. And if they don't have a problem, it's not that it wasn't there. It just was that they didn't get it because someone else got it. And out of those 100 individuals that you diagnose, the ones that you feel so proud of, 4 men will die from prostate cancer However, you will have saved one of those four men. The other three will still die of metastatic prostate cancer, regardless of how good you think your screening really is. And remember, this is prostate cancer specific mortality, meaning you can say, Mr. Jones, you are going to die at age 73, but if I screen you with this test, you're not going to die of prostate cancer at age 73, but you are still going to die at age 73. So anytime that you tell a man, listen, I can give you this test, and once this test comes back positive, I have to stick needles and tubes into your penis, and I'm going to run a test that may give you a chance that you're going to have anywhere from 50 to 80% sexual dysfunction, maybe another 30 to 50% urinary incontinence. Would you like me to do the test? The funny thing is, almost no one wants the test. But I digress, because we have two more guidelines that we need to cover before we are done here. So here we go. The next set of guidelines is the American College of Physicians Type 2 Diabetes Guidelines. They were on the hemoglobin A1C targets for glycemic control with pharmacological therapy for non-pregnant adults with Type 2 Diabetes mellitus, a guided statement update from the American College of Physicians. This is an Annals of Internal Medicine, and guidance statement number one and guidance statement number four are pretty obvious, I think. Guidance statement number one is that clinicians should personalize goals for glycemic control. I think that makes sense. That's pretty obvious. Guidance statement number four, clinicians should treat patients with type 2 diabetes to minimize symptoms related to hyperglycemia and then avoid targeting a hemoglobin A1C level in patients with a life expectancy less than 10 years due to advanced age or their comorbid condition, because in those individuals, they're not going to live very long. The harms outweigh the benefits in this population. Now, those are the two easy ones, but now there's two more guidance statements. Guidance statement two and three that I think we need to talk about. Guidance statement number two is that we should aim to achieve a hemoglobin A1C between 7 and 8. This is important because we have known since the ACCORD trial back in 2008 that found no evidence of lower risk of non-fatal myocardial infarction, non-fatal stroke, or cardiovascular death in those in the intensive arm and a median A1C of 6.4 compared with the standard treatment group that maintained a A1C median of 7.5. And I remind you, this study was done in 2008. It's almost 11 years now, and we finally are getting bench to bedside where we say, listen, A1C is between 7 and 8. Is good enough for these individuals. And then we have guidance statement number three. Guidance statement number three says you should consider to de-intensify pharmacological therapy in individuals with type 2 diabetes with a hemoglobin A1C level less than 6.5. This is huge because, as I can tell, this is one of the only guidelines that recommends de-intensifying therapy, meaning cut back therapy. Most guidelines say add a therapy, add a therapy, add a therapy. When that doesn't work, add another therapy. This one is now saying, look at this. Take back, de-intensify therapy, especially if you have hemoglobin A1C less than 6.5. All right, one last guideline, and then we'll wrap it up into a nutshell and take it home. Here we go. The last guideline is screening for cervical cancer. This is United States Preventive Services Task Force recommendation statement. This is in JAMA. And they come out and say that, listen, finally, United States Preventive Services Task Force recommends screening for cervical cancer with high-risk HPV. And if you listen to Questioning Medicine, you know that I recommended that many years ago. But finally, they listen to the podcast, they're getting on board, and they agree. Every 5 years is good enough. Now, I know some people that listen to this are going to say, listen, I just can't do this high-risk HPV thing. I think we need to do co-testing. Co-testing has to be better than high-risk HPV screening alone. You would think, except that doesn't actually bear out in the literature. It doesn't really bear out at all, but that's okay. If you want to do co-testing, that's fine. As long as you are also doing, in that co-testing, high-risk HPV. And one of the things that I do love about this is that sometimes when we do an exam, we'll do the swab and it'll come back with inconclusive cells or not enough cells or not a good sample or something like that. And then you're stuck with a dilemma of what do I do? Do I call the patient back? I have this HPV that's negative, but the swab, the cells weren't good. I can't tell what the transitional zone is. Have no fear. If she's high risk HPV negative, you don't need to call her back. It's negative. It's good enough. It is as it is, and you can follow up in 5 years. And of course, I'm referring to the women age 30 to 65, because if they're younger than 30, we don't screen with high-risk HPV. But if they're over 30 or older, again, high-risk HPV, it is game-time ready. It's been game-time ready. It's where it's at. It's where it's at. And even now, I mean, self-exams, as go back and listen to that, this is where it is. So let's wrap this up. Let's summarize this into a little nutshell, all of the articles over the last three podcasts, and I'm going to do it in a rapid-fire fashion. Here we go. Number one, aspirin not for primary prevention any longer. Number two, oral versus IV antibiotics for endocarditis. This is probably going to be happening. Again, this is special patient population. They were not IV drug users, but if you stabilize someone on IV drugs and they have good follow-up, it doesn't appear unreasonable that you could discharge them on oral antibiotics. Number three, it is good news if you are in dialysis and you have end-stage renal disease, because Hep C has a cure and we now have a plethora of new kidneys. Number four, epinephrine for out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. You sure are likely, more likely, to survive a 30-day discharge, but you're not likely to have that good of a quality of life. In fact, probably poor quality of life. Number five, isopropyl alcohol is the new antiemetic, just like orange is the new black. Number six, Gardasil number nine is now for individuals 27 through 45. Remember, men were not in that study. But we have no reason to think that it won't work for men, so go ahead and give it to them. But just a warning, this is maybe not approved by all insurances yet, so call and ask the insurance company before your patient gets stuck with a very expensive bill. Number seven, blood tests are not for concussion, but they're for intracranial lesions, and the study didn't include children, so you can't include that population if this is the test you actually want to use. Number eight, mechanical thrombectomy has changed the stroke guidelines. This is almost a 350-page stroke guideline document. This is a 2-3-hour lecture in and of itself. I would go read it if you take care of stroke patients, but this is it. This is real game time ready. Number nine, speaking of strokes, clopidogrel and aspirin right after 24 hours after a stroke or a TIA seems to be beneficial, but probably only beneficial, or at least the real benefit is in the first 7 to 10, maybe even up to 30 days, and then just straight to aspirin. Prostate cancer screening, well, it means we needed to have the discussion with the patient, and you can go online and print out that picture. Number 11, diabetes type 2. Hemoglobin A1C, the new target you're shooting for is between 7 and 8, and then de-intensify less than 6.5. And number 12, cervical cancer screening means high-risk HPV is good enough. All right, that is a wrap. That concludes this. If you have not given me a rating on iTunes, please just take 2 seconds out of your day. 2-3 seconds. In fact, if all of you that downloaded this podcast in Sacramento, California, and Town and Country, Florida, were to give me a review, I would be more than happy and not ask you on the next podcast. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can always reach me online at Andrew Bilt on Twitter, or email me andrewbilt@gmail.com. I will be more than happy to give you any and all information. If you ever want to do a grand rounds or a CME or a lecture, if you ever have something that you need done, reach out to me and let me know. But until next time, I will end this podcast as I have ended every podcast before. Until next time, keep the quest and questioning.